You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, October 11th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
How are you all doing today?
Exceptionally well, Steve.
Good. Not too bad.
Alive and kicking.
I just spent the last 4 days, literally 4 days, updating my computer. It was torture.
So wow.
It's awesome now that it's done. Everything is working fabulously, but all I wanted to do was swap out my hard drive. You know, I got a new SSD drive, two new SSD drives, actually. One for my operating system, one for my files.
How big?
2 terabytes each.
Nice.
Ooh.
Yeah, so that's good. And I can totally function off of those two drives.
Did you upgrade to Windows 98 there, Steve?
Well, I was already upgraded to Windows 10, so I'm like, all right, I'll just, you know, do a clean install of Windows 10 onto one of my new SSD drives and go from
there. Piece
of cake. Yeah, so, I mean, I knew it was going to be a torture because I had to back up everything, make sure I was 100% backed up, swap out the drives, do a clean install. Wouldn't work. Just would not work. Every time I tried to install Windows onto the new drive, it would just say, can't install onto this drive. And it took me probably 12 hours of work to get to the point where I totally solved that problem.
Jeez.
Wait. Did it take 12 hours to figure out what was going wrong, or you had to do little things over the course of 12 hours in order to get it to become right?
Well, it was troubleshooting. I mean, I did a lot of things in those 12 hours. I updated my BIOS, which actually was really, really helpful. But here's the problem very, very quickly, and I'm not an expert on this, but this is like my attempt to understand why the hell I couldn't install Windows 10 onto my drive. Are you guys aware of the fact that the BIOS has essentially been updated to a new version called UEFI?
I found out Sunday night.
That's fine. So most motherboards now use UEFI BIOS, but they are compatible with the older legacy BIOS. They can operate in a legacy BIOS mode. So apparently I was operating in the legacy BIOS mode, and when I upgraded to Windows 10, it just stayed in that legacy mode. But then when I was doing a clean install, apparently Windows 10 has shifted now to the new UEFI mode. And if you do a clean install of Windows 10, it wants to install itself in that mode. And that requires a new partition style for your hard drive. So the old partition style is the master boot record, or MBR, and the new one is the GPT, or GUID partition something.
That's oh, my God, what are you talking about?
So no, Steve, I know, right? Exactly.
Steve, is the moral of the story here, the key is confirmation BIOS?
Quad confirmation
BIOS.
This is like, I have to learn, like, every time I do a major upgrade of computer, I feel like I have to learn all this new crap that's been updated in the last couple of years. So I had to update my partition on the new drives to GPT, but I couldn't do that until I've upgraded to the new system. It wouldn't let me do it. It wouldn't let me upgrade the partition to GPT from MBR. So I was stuck. And that's what took me a long time to figure out how to do that. And eventually I did the right Google search and found the right document that told me how to do it. When you're loading up Windows 10, you have to clear the partition on the drive you want to load it to and then load it into the unpartitioned drive. And then it will automatically format it as GPT. So it's like this counterintuitive thing that you wouldn't think to do by yourself. And it took me a friggin' long time to figure that out. And it was so frustrating is the damn engineer, whoever wrote that piece of software, when you get to the point where it says you can't load Windows onto an MBR partition, you need a GPT partition, they could have just told me right at that point what I needed to do.
He's not frustrated.
No, but they were
seriously
giggling
about
behind the scenes.
How hard would it be for the program to say, just go back, delete the partition, and install into the unpartitioned drive? That's it. One sentence of actual help. Don't you love it when programs tell you this didn't work and give you no idea why it didn't work or what you need to do about it? They just totally leave you hanging.
Welcome to my world.
So frustrating.
As a Mac user, I'm just like, I have no idea what's going on.
We're talking East Coast here, not West
Coast. That said, I'm about to get a new computer, and I have to kind of take everything off of my old one and put everything on my new one, so I'll see how easy that process is for me.
You just throw everything on your Mac cloud, right, and then bring it back.
Yeah, it actually is maybe a lot easier.
Just get an external hard drive and back everything up to it.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I mean, that part's just time. I mean, that's just... You know, I mean, a lot of the time I spent was backing up everything. I mean, I have folders with 500 gigabytes of video or whatever in there that I have to like let that run overnight. So a lot of overnight copying of huge folders. But now my system is screaming. It's clean. It's everything's updated. They got the new BIOS, the new partitions, which are supposed to be more modern and better. So hope, you know, currently everything is running well.
How much actual just stuff do you have stored? Like digital stuff?
Oh my god!
Oh my god!
Oh my god!
I have
megabytes.
You know how many
hundreds of megabytes?
Kilobytes. So many kilobytes.
Right now, I have 2 2-terabyte drives that are SSD. That's what I'm operating on. Then I have a 4-terabyte media drive. I have another 4-terabyte backup drive. That's all internal. Then I have a 8-terabyte and a 5-terabyte external backup drives.
So is that because you keep every recording ever?
Partly, yeah. I mean, yeah. So it's 5 gigabytes a week doing the SGU, and I have every, you know, I have 11 years of shows.
All our raw tracks.
Yeah.
See, I don't do that with mine. Like, once mine are posted, I keep the wave or the MP3, like the final export, but I get rid of all of the working files, like the GarageBand files, like the really big ones, and I just keep the final exported file. Which actually helps me save a lot of space. But there's, I mean, that means I don't have any source files anymore, but I figure once it's online, I'm never going to need it again. Famous last words. We'll see.
Yeah, I know. Like, at first, it was like, I don't want to delete any second of Perry's recordings that I have.
Yeah.
Here, here.
When you think about it, we have about twice as much raw audio as what ends up in the final show.
Oh, if only you people knew.
Yeah, well, and there's a lot of stuff there.
We can't release any of it until we're done with the podcast.
That's right. It's going into a vault and a time capsule. You can open it 100 years after the death of the last rogue.
And of course, it's actually more than just twice because we have all of our individual files, right? Because once you stack them, the file size is a lot smaller.
Yeah.
So we've really got like almost 10 times as much content for every single show.
Well, it's twice as much time.
Twice as much time, exactly. Yeah,
it's, you know, usually we're about 2 hours and 10 minutes or so for a 1 hour and 20 to 30 minute show. So
that's but there are days where we go longer than 3 hours. It's rough.
So this week we are talking about the Nobel Prizes, the science ones anyway. And we have a great interview coming up later in the show with David Pratt, who wrote a book about the Nobel Prize. We're just going to talk about all kinds of trivia about the Nobel Prize. But first, we're going to start with a what's the word, which actually connects to one of the Nobel Prizes, Kara. So get us started with what's the word.
Yeah, so I picked one of the key words from the Nobel Prize this year in physiology or medicine, which is my kind of bigger area of interest. And the word is autophagy, which is not how I want to pronounce it. I want to call
autophagy.
It autophagy.
Autophagy, yes.
Autophagy.
But it is autophagy, so I'm going to use the correct pronunciation. It's also known as autophagia. If you do it that way, then you get to say autophagy.
Oh, that's good.
I know. You could just go that way. Autophagy, specifically, actually, let me back it up real quick, because there are two definitions of autophagia, which we're not going to discuss today because they have nothing to do with the Nobel Prize. But autophagia can describe the biting of one's own flesh. Mwah. But that's not what we're going to talk about. And it can also describe the maintenance of nutrition of the whole body by metabolic consumption of some of the body tissues. But what we're going to talk about, autophagy, is specifically what happens within an individual cell. It's the segregation and disposal of damaged organelles in that cell. It's a process of self-digestion, as the name implies, by a cell through the action of enzymes that actually originate in that same cell. It can be a defensive or a self-preservation measure. You might want to view it, if you guys remember many weeks ago, we talked about apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. This is kind of a more specific, tinier type of apoptosis in that the whole cell does not die, but a portion of the cell is kind of self-cannibalized and all the building blocks there can be reused. A more specific biological definition from another site, it's the catabolic process, meaning breaking down, of self-digestion through the lysosomal machinery, including degradation of proteins and organelles, cellular remodeling, and survival during nutrient starvation. All of that will make more sense once we jump into this Nobel Prize. Autophagy starts with the formation of a special vacuole known as the autophagosome, which makes sense. The etymology, surprisingly, goes back from before our Japanese Nobel winner this year to Belgian scientist Christian de Duve. Am I pronouncing that right, do you think? D-U-V-E? De Duve?
Or Duvet? I don't know.
Duvet? I have no idea. Like I'm going to say de Duve. Yeah, but Duvet, I don't know. I'm going to say de Duve. Who knows? Belgian scientist, in 1963, he actually discovered the lysosome. And in starting to try to work out the lysosomic pathway, he mentioned autophagy as this kind of process that was theorized but not well defined quite yet. The autophagosome comes from the Greek roots auto, meaning self, phago, meaning to eat, and soma, meaning body. So autophagy can be broken down into those first two Greek roots, auto and phago, which is self-eating.
Kara, the internet says it's de Duve. So we're going to slide into the news items. We're going to actually, Kara, start with a little bit more information about the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, which is about autophagy, but tell us about the specific discoveries that led to the prizes.
Yeah, so the Nobel Prize this year in Physiology or Medicine went to Yoshinori Osumi, who is a Japanese scientist, and he didn't discover or delineate autophagy at first. That was de Duve, but he actually elucidated the mechanisms that underlie autophagy. And he was able to do that not in human or even animal cells, but using yeast. We had been able to see under the microscope some kind of hints of autophagy. And, for many years, scientists have kind of known this to be the case because they could look at some of the outcomes of the process. But the individual mechanisms that underlie it, and especially some of the proteins that are involved, were really difficult to study. And so Yoshinori Osumi actually came up with a really ingenious way to do it in yeast. And not only was he able to directly observe autophagy in these yeast, but he was then able to elucidate the degradation enzymes involved and then specifically point to the genes that are required for the protein and protein complex cascade that forces autophagosome initiation and formation. And all of that as a basic yeast researcher, which if you've been following the news, you'll see that he's quoted as saying, "I am but a basic yeast researcher." He doesn't mean basic as in I'm not good at my job. He means I do basic science. I'm looking at these fundamental processes. I'm not looking at it in an applied way. I'm not here to try to cure any diseases. I just want to know what's happening inside of these cells.
I thought it meant he was not acidic.
Hi-yo. that said, a lot of cool stuff could come from this because it does seem to be the case that autophagy is so fundamental to cellular processes that, being able to break down old, worn-out machinery inside of the cell, use its constituent parts, and rebuild the cell so that they remain healthy throughout the lifespan is central to everything. I mean, it's central to aging, it's central to disease processes, to inflammation processes, to tumor processes. So it is really interesting that this core discovery could lead to a lot more applied discoveries.
Yeah. It's always, I do like when Nobel Prizes go to, just another researcher working on some very narrow basic science problem in the lab. I'm looking at yeast cells and autophagy but it just turns into something bigger, right? Something like, oh, yeah, this is actually a fundamental function of cells, And again, which reinforces this notion that we and, of course, other scientists advocate, which is you just need to let people do interesting basic science research and not worry about what it's going to lead to, because it leads to knowledge, and knowledge has its own end, but also you can't predict all the cool shit it's going to lead to. Just let it happen,
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, especially something where we had an idea, we kind of knew that this occurred anyway, but how it occurred, you know, I want to tinker. I want to invent new ways to be able to figure it out, to be able to image it, to be able to visualize it. And the Nobel Prizes, I think we sometimes forget that they're often awarded late in a scientist's career. The Autophagy, probably the hallmark publication of his in the Journal of Cell Biology that first described the demonstration and visualization of autophagy in yeast, was published in 1992. In 1998, the first description, or I should say the kind of hallmark description of the protein system that's essential, was published in Nature. These, you know, and this is after many, many years of investigation. So these things were happening in the mid-90s, and they just now awarded him the prize.
Okay, Evan, we're on to chemistry.
The Nobel Prize in Chemistry for 2016 has been awarded to not one, but three scientists: Jean-Pierre Sauvage, Sir J. Fraser Stoddart, and Bernard L. Farinha. And they have been awarded the prize in chemistry for the design and the synthesis of molecular machines. Cool.
Awesome.
Not just molecular machines, though. These are, in fact, the world's tiniest machines.
Ooh.
Just how tiny? Just how tiny?
Thank
you. We are talking machines which measure between 1 and 10 nanometers in width.
Wow.
That's
really small.
So they're nanomachines.
They are nanomachines. Now, by definition,
I've been focusing on physics. I have not even seen this one. I am so psyched.
Bob, no, you can't have any yet, Bob, but maybe someday you can own your own nanomachines.
Oh, I will.
And you will. By definition, a machine must have two features: one, movable parts; two, a mechanism to convert energy into motion in a predictable manner. Yeah. So at the nanoscale, this would seem impossible. But it's a damn good thing we don't stop discoveries based on our assumptions. Isn't that right? These scientists,
well,
these three scientists.
Say it seems impossible, but go on.
Well, Bob, movable parts at the nanoscale. Come on. That's pretty out there.
Yes.
Pretty out there. These scientists, working independently of each other spanning the past 35 years, have advanced the pursuit of nanomachinery like no other scientists in the world. They have designed machines as simple as a pair of molecular rings moving about each other to a design that best resembles a vehicle with four wheels that drives along a flat surface. Very cool stuff.
It's a nano car.
Yeah, it is. They did call it a nano car, and it did. It kind of looked and sort of operated fundamentally like one.
Starting with
Dr. Sauvage, back in 1983, he demonstrated the molecular chain concept of a nanomachine. So what he discovered is that you can use a copper ion as this, well, glue, for lack of a better term, in order to bind two halves of a ring within another ring to, there you go, complete your chain. That was the first main step that he came up with. It was expanded upon in 1994, where Dr. Stoddard developed what's called a molecular shuttle, in which he was able to use two molecules, one a ring and another molecule resembling an axle, one which is electric poor and the other electric rich, and as a means of adding this sort of element of movement to it. And this advancement for small-scale machines translated into certain things such as molecular elevators have been designed using this principle, or even tiny transistors on a nanoscale computer chip capable of storing 20 kilobytes of memory. So those were Dr. Stoddart's contributions to the field. And that's all well and good, but there was still this aspect of control. How do you control the motions of the energy output of the machines to behave the way the scientists want? Well, enter Dr. Farinha, who in 1999 fitted this axle ring design with rotors and then exposed it to UV light. So a flash of UV light would cause the rotors to turn 180 degrees in one direction. But then the next flash of light, of UV light, would cause the rotors to turn again. However, the direction of the turn would be random unless something else was added to the machine to prevent that random motion. And Dr. Farinha figured out that by adding methyl groups to, which is three hydrogens and one carbon molecule, they would act as an interruption of this equilibrium, and it would force the rotor to rotate the same direction as the previous rotation. So instead of it being random, you would have it rotating all in the same direction, and when you have four of these things, you know, basically you get your little car design putting right along, just using light as the energy source. By 2014, this technology advanced so far that they have built a nanomotor capable of 12 million rotations per second. So that's how far they've come with this. And like you were saying, Kara, a lot of this done in the 1980s and 1990s. And
so cool.
Here they are being recognized for these advancements.
Too bad. I mean, that's cool and all, but you know, they're not going to work inside of a biological system, because you need to shine UV light on it, but still cool.
Could work inside of a see-through animal.
Bob, this is just the beginning, you know, and I don't think it's wrong to say that cells and the inner workings of cells are nanomachines.
Yeah, of course they are.
They're nanomachines.
Yeah, they are. They're just biological machines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That's a proof of concept right there.
My sense is that one of the big breakthroughs here was getting molecules to interact mechanically rather than through like covalent bonds. That was sort of the big breakthrough with the link. You know, obviously there's no like really direct application to this yet, but we're just building the basic technology of getting machines to do basic things like move, rotate, you know, whatever, at the nanoscale. And, you know, this is going to take time. This is in its infancy. Mm. We're going to have to build up a base of knowledge about all the different ways to build and manipulate this matter. And then, you know, at some point, the applications will come.
Sure. And this happened how long ago? I mean, where are they with this kind of stuff now?
Nanomotors capable of 12 million rotations per second, yeah. which is a lot. But at the nanoscale, it doesn't exactly, you know, get you across the country in a decent amount of time. But hey.
Across a cell.
All right, Bob, you're going to tell us about the Nobel Prize in Physics. Now, this one is a little complicated. You're going to have to walk us through it.
Yeah, so gird your loins for this one.
hang on, Bob.
I'd love that expression. First, I want to say congratulations to David Thewlis of the University of Washington for his half of the Physics Nobel Prize, and F. Duncan Haldane of Princeton and J. Michael Kosterlitz of Brown University for their half of the prize. Now, in the words of the Academy itself, they won for their theoretical discoveries of topological phase transitions and topological phases of matter. Another way to generally describe their accomplishment is that they've dramatically changed the way scientists think about condensed matter physics. So what the holy hell is all that? So ultimately, this prize deals with topology. Which you can look at topology as a modern form of geometry, or you can think of it as a rubber sheet geometry, as it's been referred to. So let's look at the different types of geometry and see how they're different, and that might help you understand what topology is. So we all know Euclidean geometry on some level. We've all taken it in class, I'm sure. With Euclidean geometry, you can flip things, squares and circles and lines and things like that, and you can move these shapes around, but you can't bend them or stretch them. Two things are the same if you could lay one on top of the other and they match. If they match, they are the same. You're
done. That's a proof, right?
Yes, that's pretty much. I mean, by definition, they are the same if they match. Projective geometry deals with probably obviously projected shapes. It says two things are the same if each is a different view of the same thing. So a circle and ellipse then are the same because, say, for example, a frisbee is a circle from overhead, but it's also an ellipse from a lower angle. So they are the same according to projective geometry. So for topology, two things are the same if you can push or pull or squeeze one shape into another shape. So a circle is the same as a square. A sphere is the same as a pyramid or even a bowl, because you could take each one of those and kind of squish it and push it and tug it into these other shapes. You're not allowed to break or glue pieces of these things that will...
But I'm sorry, Bob. Are we talking surface area or volume?
Topology is volume. That's why I said a sphere. I guess you could apply it to other shapes, but it's primarily, when I think of topology, I'm thinking more three-dimensional. But it can apply to other dimensions. Within topology, holes are supremely important. So a donut with one hole, a pretzel with two or three holes, or a muffin with no holes are then completely distinct topological objects. If you add or remove a hole, you have a completely changed the topology of that shape. So, okay, so that's topology. What about condensed matter physics? This one's a little bit easier to describe. It deals with the behavior of huge collections of atoms in a solid or liquid. So these trillions of interacting objects cannot each be counted or simultaneously tracked. So it deals with the behavior of these huge assemblages of atoms. So those are two big key concepts you need to even begin to get a handle on what these guys actually did. So the question then is, what problem did these guys actually solve? So it has to do with condensed matter physics. Condensed matter physics is just too complex to calculate how these trillions of atoms are going to behave when they get together and have one of their nasty little parties. It's just way too complicated. Typically, in physics, you use reductionism to deal with complexity like this. So say, for example, you want to learn about motion. What is motion? You could imagine something like a baseball, but you want to simplify this. You want to remove or ignore things like friction or air resistance so that you can get at the core of motion itself, the fundamental underlying laws. Then once you've got a handle on that, and you know, with that information, you could definitely say some very interesting things. But once you get a handle on that, then you could add those other complications like friction back in to understand how things behave in the real world. That works on so many different things at so many levels for physics, from a particle to huge astronomical objects. It works wonderfully, but it doesn't always work. This kind of reductionism doesn't work well, for example, for condensed matter physics. Once you add those real world factors back in, things get crazy really fast. But you have to add those real world things back into it, because that's how you're going to get the really good answers. Otherwise, it's just going to be minimally helpful. So what these scientists did was use topology to look at all the parts of the system at once. So for example, they looked at a superfluid. Superfluids are super cold liquids that flow without resistance. These are like superconductors, but instead of electrons, it's with a liquid. The liquids can actually do stuff like climb up and out of beakers and other batshit crazy stuff, amazing stuff, totally counterintuitive. Do a Google search on videos of superfluids, amazing stuff. So what they did is they looked at slices of this superfluid topologically. And when they saw this. Imagine tornado-like vortices, one spinning to the right, one is spinning to the left. Each of these vortices pair up. They kind of get together. So when that happens, they essentially cancel out their individual behavior, and that preserves the superfluidity. So these two things that should disrupt the superfluid flow, they get together, they cancel out, superfluidity is maintained. All right, so here's now where I kind of bring all of this back together. These vortices act like holes. They are like holes which give the slice of liquid a specific topology. Remember I said holes are very important. If you can identify the holes in a shape, then you can understand what its topology is. So if you treat these vortices like holes, you're looking at it topologically. So when the liquid warms up, though, when you add energy to it, the paired vortices break up. And the superfluid behavior goes away because there's no longer any of that paired canceling effect. So each individual spinning vortice disrupts the superfluid flow now once it starts warming up. So by looking at the topology, it then gives you the insight into the behavior of this condensed matter system. Huge, huge, huge advance there. So this new tool that these physicists developed, it's like coming up with the first digital projected animation for a haunted house. It makes you look at creating a haunted house differently and more efficiently. It's not a perfect analogy, but hey, it's the middle of October. Physicist Eduardo Fradkin said, this was the first time the concepts of topology became relevant in condensed matter physics. It's a tool most physicists didn't have before then. So this new tool lets them tackle problems they never could have before. They can now ask and answer questions they wouldn't have dreamed of attempting previously. So this new tool, this is what these guys have contributed. They're giving physicists a new tool to do things in the future that they never would have been able to do otherwise. And that makes it a very, very powerful discovery.
Bob, wait, can you start again?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, said something about Euclid, right?
Yeah, what does Maxwell Smart used to say? Yeah, just explain to me that I got everything except for one thing, the part after. And then he says, like, whatever.
What did you say after Gird Your Loins? What was that?
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that one bit again. Yeah. And if you are interested in the details, actually, the Nobel website has really good write-ups of each Nobel Prize. And they have one write-up that is popular. So it doesn't use any jargon and it's a little bit more condensed, but still pretty extensive. Then it has the technical background if you really want to get into the details.
Yeah. So,
but that's not for the faint of heart. But
oh, same thing with the autophagy thing. Like, they get into all of the proteins and all of the cascades, which we like didn't touch at all.
Okay. Jay, you're going to cover a news item that is actually from last week, but it's very interesting. We just didn't have time to get to it last week about longevity. The lifespan of humans.
There's a recent study about the human lifespan, and they made some interesting conclusions. And the study states that the maximum age for a human is somewhere around 115 years. And I was surprised to hear that.
Why?
I don't know.
That it can't get any further naturally at 115 years. That's really
isn't the record
the end of the line, right?
Isn't the record like 122?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it was 122.
I
don't know. Like my gut, without really thinking about it, my gut was always like, the upper limit might be, 150s and or something in that range without a big medical intervention. But listen to the study. Listen to what they did, and we'll talk about it after you hear the whole thing. So the study included death statistics from 38 countries, and they determined the oldest age of death per country per year. And they also looked at the change in life expectancy per age group. And it's important to note that life expectancy in this study refers to the number of years a person is statistically likely to live from their current age on, not from birth. So the three authors, Dong, Milhound, and Vijg.
Oh, jeez.
Vijg?
Yeah, thanks.
Probably
right?
Just Vij.
Vij.
I'm sure it's just Vij.
V-Man.
So these three people focused on lifespan and not life expectancy. So their lifespan definition is the maximum number of years a species can live if they had optimal health, zero accidents, and zero disease. So we just said that the top age was 122 years. This is recorded and probably verifiable. And it was Jean Calment. And she died in 1997. Now, she's not the norm. And with a large data set, it's expected to have an outlier or a handful of outliers that don't really fit into what's expected. Now, I didn't think 122 was that much higher than 115, but apparently, anything above 115 from the results of this study would be considered quite a feat.
Wait, I'm confused. Does that mean with no medical intervention?
No, with current medical intervention.
But why would you need medical intervention if you never have disease?
Meaning being free of anything that would kill you. That's basically what it is.
Gotcha.
It's like, so eventually your body is just going to give out, right? It's just going to stop.
Eventually you'll probably die of cancer.
The maximum theoretical lifespan means when will your body give out? Even if you never get cancer, never have a heart attack, it's just done.
Wears out.
It just
stops
working.
So, so let me continue. So looking at the oldest person's age at death per country, the researchers found that there was an increase from 1970 to the year 2000. Now, this topped off at 115 years, right? So that's 41,975 days. And that means, barring sleep and the first 5 years of life, you can watch Star Wars Episode 4 3,260 times a year times 110 years equals 358,600 times in your lifespan.
New Hope. Wow.
Yep.
Awesome.
And that wouldn't kill you?
No, I didn't say that. But I'm just, as a point of reference.
In Jay's case, it would keep him going.
To those that need a way to understand big numbers like this, that's how many times you can watch Episode 4. It gives you a little perspective. Okay, so anyway. The authors also studied the age that had the greatest annual increase in survival. And this number was increasing from 1920 to 1980, and then it plateaued at around 100 years. Now, this means that life never got better than the 1980s. And I'm sure that David Lee Roth would agree. It only increased by 1 to 2 years since then. Does that make sense?
I think it still got better.
Yeah, so the hypothesis was that if the maximum lifespan were increasing, then the age at which life expectancy was increasing the most would be increasing, and it didn't. So this is just ways of inferring if life span is increasing or if it's leveling off. And these two measures both show that lifespan is essentially flattening out.
Right.
The authors
took those two key trends, and then they calculated that the maximal lifespan would end up around 115 years.
Another way to look at that, if you track how many people reach, you know, their 100th year or 110th year or 120th year, if you look at some of those numbers, you could see that perhaps there's been, you know, an increase in the number of people that break 100, but the amount of people that break 110 has not been going up at all. And that is another way to look at, you know, that's the maximum age. We're just not having more people reach that. It was kind of another way.
Yeah, the bell curve sort of shifts a little bit. Yeah.
115 is like the average maximum lifespan of people. There may be some people pushing it to 120, 122, I think is the oldest, but that we're not going to see people living to 130, 135.
You're right
as of today.
You're right next to the wall at 122, 123. You're right by the wall.
Yeah.
So listen to this.
As of today.
Aubrey de Grey, a biomedical gerontologist, Steve?
Gerontologist.
We've had on the show.
Yeah, years we met ago, him at TAM, as a matter of fact.
It was lovely beard.
Yeah.
And he is the chief science officer of the SENS Research Foundation at Mountain View, California. Now, he disagreed.
That is real tight.
Okay. He disagreed, but only in that the paper they're talking about current and past medicine, but does not factor in the potential of future medicine. He said everything is good.
Yeah, that's why I was saying today.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's important to factor in when you think about, you know, what are we going to achieve over the next 10 to 20 years. Now, wait.
Oh, my
now, keep
God,
that thought.
So much.
But wait. Keep that in mind, right? All right, so because that's what Aubrey's saying. Like, okay, so what's going to happen in the future and how much impact is that going to have? Now, I do believe that it's going to have an impact. However, an interesting point to consider is that modern medicine has contributed greatly, right, to achieving the 115-year mark, but that peaked, as I said, 20 years ago. So not much has happened in the past 20 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and we're just to reinforce this difference, we're talking about lifespan, not life expectancy. Life expectancy is statistically how long you're likely to live. That's been going up, and that could get closer and closer and closer to 115, meaning that on average more people are living longer, but they're still going to drop dead at 115 or thereabouts. What's interesting in this debate is, you know, does this flattening out of the increase of lifespan that we've seen in the last 20 years, is that, how much of a limit is that? At the most pessimistic end, you could say that's it. That's the absolute limit. Aubrey de Grey obviously thinks that it's just a matter of finding new technologies. My interpretation is that the 115 limit, that's the limit that you can get to from just treating disease and promoting health.
Nutrition and all that, yeah.
But that doesn't mean you can't break through that barrier, but I think doing so requires game-changing technology.
Yes, exactly.
Like CRISPR. And I think we're on the precipice
of
that.
Right, Steve? How about CRISPR?
I think that genetic manipulation is one of the things that we may need to do, you know, that in order to push past
personalized medicine. We've never had really good personalized medicine, and I think it's starting to happen. And I think genetic manipulation is going to be one of those things. We've had very good one-size-fits-all treatments, but only now are we starting to see really specific and acute change in cancer treatment by being able to find labels on tumors, by being able to figure out exactly the type of cells that are involved and being able to target them in a way that is very specific.
I don't think that's
going to
do it. I think personalized medicine will increase the life expectancy, get more people up to the 115 level, but I don't think it's going to push past 115 because it's not changing the fundamental limits of your cells.
I disagree because I have a hard time, and I would love to hear what you guys have to say about this. I have a hard time with the premise that because people haven't lived past 115 historically, they can't live past 115, or that when they die around 115, they're dying just of, quote, old age, which isn't a thing. Like, when people die, there's always a cause of death.
Of course, yeah.
And generally speaking, by time you're reaching 115,
their heart stops,
most often you're dying because you have systemic organ failure from an infection that your body's no longer strong enough to fight, or you have organ failure as a result. Many people, if they live that long, have dementia. They have Alzheimer's, or they have some form of cancer. Most people, when they get to 115, have battled with cancer in their lives. It's a normal function of extended aging. And I think that if we can reverse cancer, we're going to see the limit on life go way up.
I disagree. I think ultimately what they have is they've identified seven or eight or so things that happen in the body that are the major contributors to aging. Things like, you know, intracellular junk that just accumulates. We don't have great mechanisms to
clean up autophagy. It starts to fade.
The detritus that accumulates. Metabolism has byproducts. We can get rid of some of them, but ultimately, if you look at different organisms,
they accumulate.
Their life expectancy is in a major way dependent on how good they are at cleaning out some of this stuff.
Okay, that was one of the seven.
So think about this analogy. I like this analogy because I just updated my computer. When you occasionally have to clean up your computer, you can clean out old programs, et cetera, but eventually you need a clean install, right? You get to the point where your system just is slow and buggy and just not working well, and you can't really fix it. You just got to do a clean install. So that's the same thing with biology, with any complex machine or thing or system, is that little tiny errors and junk and whatever just accumulate over time, and you can repair them, you can fix them, but you can't totally get rid of them. At some point you need to hit the reset button. Hitting the reset button is like having children, right? That's why we have the unbroken chain of life for 4 billion years.
Germ cells.
And that's why, like, there's that jelly, right? That jelly that could live forever because it basically disperses itself.
Yeah, it goes back into
it. Just renews itself over and over again. At some point, you need a new cell that has a clean start.
But that's kind of what I'm saying
to some extent.
Yeah, but the problem there is your brain. It's your brain, because that's something you can't. If you give yourself new brains, you know, a new brain, it's not you anymore. That's
no, that's true. But I do think if we can understand the cellular mechanism, this is my Nostradamus moment.
Give us your quatrain.
Give it to me, and you can disagree. But I think that the future of medicine is going to be a fundamental understanding that the same processes that are involved in cancer biology are heavily implicated in these kinds of processes, the aging and the wearing out of cellular mechanics, the detritus that builds up, and the, quote, aging process as a whole. I think that those processes are highly correlated and related within the cell. And I think that once we can start to clean up and refresh and renew the cellular machinery and the DNA repair processes, we're going to see lifespan really extended. It's two sides of the same coin for me. Cancer biology and aging.
So I'll agree with you to the extent that when we can start to fundamentally enhance, prolong, you know, fix cellular mechanisms, like increase those telomeres and clean out the detritus and change the genes and do things like that, then we'll be able to push past 115. That's something. We need new things that we're not doing now, not just treating disease, but actually
promoting,
prolonging cell function. But it's interesting that the risk of cancer increases with age pretty much throughout your whole life until you get to about 100, and then the risk actually goes down.
That is interesting.
Whoa. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So that means that
interesting.
That
what the
people who are living past that point just don't get cancer.
Yeah, it's that they've been able to live that long because they've been resistant to cancer, and that's, they're
selecting out a group of people who statistically.
So it's not those individuals are less likely to get cancer after that. It's that whole group is a less likely cancer group.
Well, it's by the group. Your risk of getting cancer, if you live past 100, actually starts to go down.
You probably would have had it already. But then the fear is, do you have Alzheimer's? Do you have Parkinson's? Do you have some other?
Okay, how about this, Kara? Another thing. So a few years ago, the oldest person alive, who was 115, died. They autopsied her, and they, as a woman, they looked at her brain, and she had the brain of a 50-year-old. She did not have any plaques or tangles or atrophy.
We need her cells. We need her
cells. And she was sharp. By report, she had 115. She was intellectually sharp. So the and this is not an isolated case. Mm-hmm. The what it seems that about 1-2% of people just don't develop the age-related changes to the brain that everyone else does. So again, we need to identify those genes.
Yes,
you know,
and then dope with them, all of us.
Yes, we need the we need those genes of people who don't get heart disease and don't get cancer and don't get age related changes to the brain. And then, you know, we put all of those, and you know, we're talking about the lucky few who make it to 115 or just the people who happen to have just by random chance enough of those good genes that they could live that long. So,
Steve, one thing I would say is, you know, the reformat would kind of be ideal, but I don't think you necessarily need the reformat. You could get, say, therapies that roll back, you know, some of these problems that have been identified as primary causes of aging. And even with that limited therapy, the non-ideal therapy, I think you could go, say, from 120 to 150. You still a nice bump.
Maybe, but I think our best gains are going to be made from stem cells. Because that's basically they are. Mm-hmm. It's like here's new fresh cells that are going to replace your old crappy tired cells. If we can get get our organs to renew themselves from stem cells, then that I think could add decades to lifespan. Again, the one organ where that's a problem is your brain. But even there, you know, you can just make neural stem cells that can then engage in new connections. You're not necessarily replacing old cells. You're just allowing for new cells to make connections and to keep going.
Yeah, it can't be all or nothing or all at once. It would have to be like a slow infusion so that the pruning process,
Yeah, it's over time. Yeah, you're not just like growing a new brain in a week, but you're just allowing for a continuous turnover with fresh, healthy cells. All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy.
It was a toxic chair. We are still two men, but in the foot in money, sit out of each other in the foot and gaggle can little geese hole. I'm twice.
All right, what was that, guys?
I know your hint was.
It's either.
Well, you gave us really two hints. One was that we don't know what this is, and the second one was that it was from Charlie at Google. So obviously it sounds like superficially a foreign language, and I think what you're saying is it's not a foreign language. It's something else, some other manipulation of speech that it has to do with some kind of Google technology, I guess.
I just thought it was a lady speaking in French.
It almost sounds like you're hearing partial parts of words or the last syllables of a bunch of words strung together.
Is it, Jay, is it an amalgam of all Google searches?
It's interesting. No, this is what I would consider to be one of the coolest things that I discovered this year, thanks to Charlie. This is WaveNet, not to be confused with Skynet. WaveNet. So WaveNet is it's a neural network producing speech sounds without the guidance of what to actually say. In this instance, this is a computer pretending to sound like a human being without having any understanding of language or grammar. So it is exactly what it's exactly like the computer. A computer is doing what we do when, say, an English speaking person tries to talk German.
Yeah,
or sound like German.
So it's all nonsensical.
So it's like a talented alien trying to mimic human speech.
That's what that was that I played. Now, however, this gets really freaking interesting because WaveNet is a paradigm change in the way that they model a raw waveform of an audio signal, right? So let me go through a little history here. We've all used something called concatenative TTS, or we've heard mimicked voice through this process. So this is when you hear a robot voice or like a fake human voice. This is one way that they do it. Now this is they take a very large database of short speech fragments and they're recorded from a single speaker, right? And then they recombine them to form complete utterances. Here's an example of the concatenative TTS.
The Blue Lagoon is a 1980 American romance and adventure film directed by Randall Kleiser.
Okay, now moving on to parametric TTS. Now, this is where all the information required to generate the data the sound file, is stored in the parameters of the model. And the contents and characteristics of the speech can be controlled via the inputs to the model. So you know, as an example, the parametric TTS tended to sound less natural than the concatenative. So here's a sample of the parametric TTS.
The Blue Lagoon is a 1980 American romance and adventure film directed by Randall Kleiser.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's much better.
That's better.
Yeah.
Now, oh,
much
to
more human-like, yes.
The Blue Lagoon is a 1980 American romance and adventure film directed by Randall Kleiser.
Now,
oh, that's really
that's
good.
That
99% of the way there.
That's damn good.
That has mouth noise, breath, right? They have a lot of parameters in there. So WaveNet actually is creating real voice where they can change a parameter and say, we want that voice. Okay, I like this sounding voice. Give it an Italian accent, and they can do it.
Whoa.
Yes, and make it sound scared, and they can do it.
Jesus.
Because they've already come up with the formula to do all those things, right? So you can be hand-shaping accents and hand-shaping emotion in the voice and all this stuff. This is like I couldn't help but extrapolate this to, you know, we could be using computers to play characters in movies where one person sitting there could actually make the entire movie without even having actors involved at that point.
Damn,
I'm not
man.
Saying good or bad, good, bad, or indifferent. I'm just giving you an example of like real time computer processing. Some, you know, in the not too distant future is going to be able to say whatever it wants. You won't have to have a voice actor, you know, say all the lines anymore. All right. So the winner for this noisy, this was John Kirkham, and John said, I love the show and have been listening from the start. Finally, there's a Who's That Noisy that I'm pretty sure I know what it is. The audio comes from deepmind.com. WaveNet use of deep neural networks for generating waveforms, including speech and speech-like babbling. Very good. Very good, John. So this week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Matt Dick. Take a listen. What is this? Be specific.
Who's That Noisy is an exercise in making Kara feel uncomfortable. It's like every week you play a noise that's just a little uncanny valley and wrong and weird.
You're right, but then it always turns out to be something cool and you love it, so don't worry about it.
It's always really cool. It's just like it's familiar but not quite familiar.
Right.
So it's a little like unsettling.
If you think you know what the answer is to this week's noisy, or you have a cool noisy that you found, please send it to me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do one email this week. This comes from Adam Stone from Pennsylvania. And Adam writes, hey, guys, quick question about the end of episode 550. At the end, Steve and Evan were talking about how you can't describe food as healthy, only nutritious. I was confused by what Steve meant when he said how food is good for you and that there's nothing special about certain foods. I thought it was reasonable to say that kale is far more nutritious than, say, French fries, therefore kale is better for your health. I think I'm missing the point of what you guys meant, so could you clarify? I know you're all very busy, so no worries. If you don't have the time, keep up the great work. That's a good question, Adam. We do get similar questions a lot. I think that the idea that certain things to eat are inherently healthful is one of the greatest marketing scams of our time. It is basically people trying to sell you stuff. It's a marketing ploy. The notion is that no food is inherently healthful or not healthful. You just need to eat a variety of foods so that you have a good balance of nutrients. French fries could be part of that balance, just like kale can be. There's nothing inherently bad about French fries. You shouldn't live on French fries because it's a lot of calories and it's narrow.
You shouldn't live on kale either.
You shouldn't live on kale either. Yeah, I mean, what is unhealthful is having a narrow diet or eating just a few things or eliminating entire categories of food. The variety is your friend. Yeah, just have a good variety. And that should include sufficient plants, right? Fruits and vegetables. But that's really a specific piece of advice because the Western diet may not inherently contain enough fruits and vegetables. If we rely too much on meats and potatoes, we're getting good, you know, carbs and proteins, but we may not be getting all of the vitamins and stuff that we need. Kale is a great example of a fake superfood, right? I mean, it's like the latest, the latest health food craze, but there is absolutely nothing special about kale. And this is the other part of what we were saying. There's no such thing as a superfood, but the whole notion of a superfood is fake. It's a total marketing ploy. It's not a valid scientific concept or valid nutrition concept. And all the things that people promote as quote unquote superfoods are, even if you look specifically at the nutrients they contain, they're not as good as everyday common foods that people eat, right? You're better off having broccoli versus kale, or having blueberries versus some exotic tropical fruit, acai berries, whatever the crap they're trying to sell you these days.
Acai. Oh, yeah. People love that here in LA.
It's nonsense. You're being had. It's total scam. And we know how the scam works. What the people identify first is a source of something exotic. They say, oh, let's corner the market on acai berries.
Mm-hmm.
And once we've done that, now we're going to totally invent out of whole cloth this notion that they're super healthy. And then we'll market this thing that we've already secured a supply line for. It's made up. It's literally made up to sell you stuff. There's no science to it. And if you look at it, it's like strawberries have more nutrients than acai berries do of the things that they're supposed to be, you know, supposed to have a lot of. Or, you know, I love the pond scum one, you know, the one where you have to eat the algae, the super blue green algae. Yeah, you know, you're better off eating broccoli than super blue green algae, whatever. Just, you know, eat the foods that you like, eat a variety. You don't have to, you know, just because something was grown in a different part of the world doesn't make it better for you. You know?
And really also, everybody has different requirements. Yeah. There's this great paper that was just written in Popular Science yesterday, an article by Ian Graber Steele that I came across when I saw that we were going to answer this email. The headline is, "Calling food healthy doesn't really mean anything. Nutritionists and food policy experts say the word is nothing more than a marketing term." And it goes through, just like you said, Steve, and it goes through and details a 1994 FDA decision to regulate the word healthy. Article that was published in JAMA just in September that said that in the 60s, when we first started talking about how fat and sugar are dangerous, the sugar lobby actually started to try to put all of the marketing on fat being unhealthy. Right. And so we were able to market things like fat-free pudding as healthy.
All right. Thanks for the question, Adam. We are joined now by David Pratt. David, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you, Steve.
And you are joining us to talk about one of your areas of expertise, the Nobel Prize. Obviously, all the science Nobel Prizes were announced last week, and we're talking about them on the show this week. So tell us about your work with following the Nobel Prize over a very long time, apparently. Tell us about that.
Well, Steve, the project began with my interest in quotations, and that's a lifelong interest. I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, I found I had quite a few quotations by Nobel Prize winners. So I started reading books by and about Nobel Prize winners and ended up reading almost 2,000.
Oh!
made a collection and published it of 1,000 quotations by Nobel Prize winners. And this led me, from all the biographies and autobiographies I'd read, into an interest in their lives. And the question, what made a Nobel Prize winner? And so I devoted a couple of years to that and produced a book called Nobel Laureates, The Secret of Their Success, which came out earlier this year.
So I know this, probably everyone gives you this question, but I have to ask it. Do you have your single favorite Nobel laureate quote?
Well, I have 1,000, actually.
I love that.
How about never give in? Never give in. That's Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill, I recognize that, sure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, he's doing it with Winston Churchill being on the list. You got a ton of quotes right there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I write on your website, a fanatic is the one who can't change his mind and won't change the subject. Winston Churchill, yeah. We encounter those every now and then, yeah.
Yes, wonderful epigrams he coined.
In your recent book that you published this year about the secret of their success, did you uncover any interesting patterns or connections among the Nobel winners?
Yes, I did. To cut to the chase, the one indispensable and universal attribute that Nobel Prize winners have, whatever the field, peace, literature, economics, or the sciences, is a passionate devotion to their field.
And that's true, again, whether it was a scientific Nobel or a Peace Prize or literature.
There's virtually no exceptions to that rule.
Was there anything that was surprising? Because again, that's kind of an obvious one that we would expect to see.
Well, one or two things. Some of them somewhat trivial, but the average divorce rate in the United States and Canada is around 40%. Amongst Nobel scientists, it's 7%.
Really?
Hmm. I would think it would be the opposite.
Yeah.
You never come home. You're always working, you fanatic.
Yeah, that's right. Obviously, they make good decisions about choosing supportive spouses.
Do you think it goes deeper than that, though? I mean, there may be something about the personality of somebody who could be so dedicated. I mean, maybe the dedication to their marriage is a reflection of the dedication to their career.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Yes, I think so. About twice the normal rate amongst Nobel Prize winners grew up with only one parent. Many of them lost their fathers when they were below the age of 11, a surprising number. So this, like the marriage statistics, suggests that Nobel Prize winners are supported by strong women, either by their wives or by their mothers.
But that also kind of brings up another issue, which is a lot of the Nobel Prize winners are men. Do you know offhand like how many women won the Nobel Prize since its inception? 1901 was the first year, correct?
I'm not sure I'm absolutely correct, but I think it's 44. It's over the history of the Nobel Prize, it's been 5%. But in the 21st century, it's been 15%. So the Nobel Foundation is clearly making an effort to seek nominations of women, both for the sciences and for the other prizes.
So I went from 5% to 15%. I guess that's progress. But it takes a long time, obviously, to progress in your career. And then the Nobels tend to come very late in life. So I guess if we were reaching gender equality, which we're not, but let's say we were getting close to that now, it might take 20, 30, 40 years before that would be reflected in the Nobel Prize.
Yes, and I think there are systemic obstacles to women achieving the highest positions in the sciences. The most notable one, which still prevails today, it has in the past, is that a person's most productive years in the laboratory also happen to coincide with a woman's most fertile years. And being in the lab at 3 a.m. is not totally compatible with having young babies at home. And for this reason, my suspicion is that many very promising women scientists go into teaching universities rather than research universities, or go into industry where the demands are not quite so exorbitant.
And I brought up the issue of age. I read recently, and tell me if you encountered this in your research as well, that the average age of a Nobel Prize winner is actually increasing over time.
Of course, the age gap is very wide between the discovery and the award of the Nobel. It's about 15 years. Typically, Nobel Prize-winning research is done in the scientist's 30s, but 30s or early 40s, but the award usually comes in the late 50s.
Yeah, because it takes time to see that their discovery holds up. You know, it had an influence on the field.
Unless it's the Higgs.
There are some which have been awarded very fast. The notable one is the discovery of insulin by Banting and Best. Actually, it was Banting and McLeod who got the prize. But I think that was awarded a year after the discovery. But that's very much the exception.
Over the last century, there was a couple of Nobel Prizes that maybe were awarded too quickly. Do you have any favorite examples of awards that we look back on now with the benefit of history and we say, oh, that was kind of a bad decision?
Well, I think Egon Moniz would be one, the Portuguese physician who was awarded the prize for inventing the prefrontal lobotomy. Oh. And very few years after that, psychotropic medicines were discovered, and the lobotomy fell into disuse. Another example might be Henry Kissinger, who was awarded the prize for his efforts towards peace in Vietnam, but peace didn't come nearly as fast as the Nobel Committee had believed or wished.
What are your opinions about awarding Barack Obama the Nobel Peace Prize at the beginning of his presidency? A lot of people thought that was a bit odd.
Yes, it was a bit exceptional because there have been four presidents who've won the Nobel Prize, and all of the others, it's been on account of their achievements. I think probably the Nobel Committee was very influenced by his Cairo speech, where he laid out what would be the basis of American foreign policy under his presidency. And I think they wanted to encourage him. And this is one role which Nobel Prizes sometimes take, perhaps particularly in literature, to take somebody relatively early in their career and encourage the path they're on.
Yeah, although that does seem to be kind of the opposite of how we think of the prize, you know, as opposed to coming later as in hindsight, a recognition of accomplishments that have stood the test of time. And that kind of stood in stark contrast to that, I thought.
Yes, I think you're quite right about that, Steve. Of course, the Nobel Prize also went to Theodore Roosevelt, the prize for peace, although he's probably the most bellicose president that the United States has had. But he was awarded it for his role in negotiations between Russia and Japan, ending the Russo-Japanese War. Yasser Arafat was perhaps the most controversial ever. Because of his history as a terrorist, it was very much opposed by many people in the world. The Nobel Committee was recognizing his development in the sense that he renounced terrorism and accepted Israel's right to exist. And it was on those grounds and because of the negotiations with Israel that he was given the prize. But that was very controversial.
Yeah, even till today, I think. You know, it's because, you know, giving a peace prize to a terrorist, even just for not being a terrorist anymore. I mean, I can understand the idea behind it, but yeah, I could also see why that would be very controversial.
Yes. In my earlier book of Nobel quotations, I put in a few quotations from Yasser Arafat and received my share of abuse on that ground. He said, "I come today holding an olive branch in one hand and a gun in the other. Do not let the olive branch fall from my hand."
Hey, okay.
Mm. All right.
That's interesting.
That is a very provocative quote. Well, David, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't think to ask you that is so cool about the Nobel Prize?
Well, off the top of my head, I think you covered the ground really well. You didn't ask me what the Nobel scientists would advise how young scientists should organize their career.
All right, well, what's their advice?
Linus Pauling said, "How do you get good ideas? You have to have a lot of ideas and throw out the bad ones."
I think Edison would agree with that.
Yep. That's my approach to photography. I take a shitload of pictures. No one has to see the bad ones.
That was my approach to dating, by the way.
James Watson said, "If you're the best in your class, you're in the wrong class."
Whoa, I like it. I like it.
I'm going to borrow that.
And Leon Lederman said, "My ambition is to live to see all of physics reduced to a formula so elegant and simple that it will fit easily on the front of a T-shirt."
Yeah, I remember that one. That's awesome.
I feel the same way. Just waiting. Still waiting.
All right. Well, David, thank you so much for joining us. This is fascinating.
Been a pleasure, Steve. Thank you for such a pleasant interview.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake, and you, of course, can have fun playing at home. I understand this is a very popular segment of our show. A lot of people enjoy, you know, tell us that they play against each other and their family and everything, and it's a lot of fun. But you guys playing against me. You ready for this week?
Yes.
All right. You backed into a sweep last week.
Backed into it. We totaled
backed into it. We right for the wrong reason, but that's okay.
God, don't even.
It's always the wrong reason.
Okay. All right, here we go.
Here we go.
Item number one. Astronomers have discovered a solar system with three separate and misaligned planet-forming disks. Item number two, nanoengineers have created a system that transforms nanoparticles into universal modular and then in quotes, Lego-like building blocks. And item number three, in the first head-to-head comparison between doctors and computer-based diagnostic systems, the computer-based systems outperform the human doctors in making correct diagnoses by 20%. Evan, go first.
Okay, the first one, astronomers have discovered a solar system with three separate and misaligned planet-forming disks.
Do you understand what I mean by that?
Well, because the planets typically form in one disk.
One
right?
plane, yeah.
One
so imagine
plane.
There's three planetary planes all like askew. You know, they're all at different angles and stuff.
That's unconventional. However, I don't think that that's impossible. Because perhaps the solar system emerged at some point with another system, became one solar system, and you've had these planes of planets at different angles, and then along comes a third merger of some sort. So perhaps it became a merger, and what ultimately ended up is one solar system. That's why you have these misaligned ones. So I think that's what might be going on there. The next one about nanoengineers having created a system transforming nanoparticles into universal modular Lego-like building blocks. This one is interesting. Lego-like building blocks. So I guess Lego-like meaning that they just lock in. They click together in a certain sense. But into universal modular Lego-like building blocks. Boy, that's some science right there. That sounds like a huge step. I don't know about this one. I'm not sure we're there yet. The last one, the first head-to-head comparison between doctors and computer-based diagnostic systems. The computer-based system outperformed the human doctor in making correct diagnoses by 20%. That seems like a lot. Are they there? Are they really there yet? I didn't think they were quite there yet. I thought they were maybe on par, just the computers were just catching up to the human doctors. I think this one's premature. So I'll say that the doctor-computer head-to-head, the computers are not outpacing us doctors by 20%. But maybe the real item here is that they've just crossed the threshold either or are now on par with doctors. But I don't think they've gone over by 20%.
Okay, Bob. What the hell? The misaligned disks, wow. I hadn't thought of a solar system merger. Two things. I would think that this would be an incredibly brief period of time in the life of a solar system, which makes it very unlikely for us to discover it. I mean, I think that those orbits would stabilize after a while, and the planet just could not exist. Unless you've got planets, you know, in an outer orbit in one plane, and then other planets in an inner orbit in another plane, then I can kind of see that, because then there would be no real gravitational interaction. So I can imagine how it's possible. The second one, I may just have to say that science, the universal modular Lego nanoblocks, that's just so awesome. It does seem a little bit too good to be true, maybe a lot too good to be true. But I'd want that to be true so badly. And sure, I could see that happening at this point. Man, they've been trying to do this for so long. It's huge. And I just don't know how I didn't see any of this crap. And then we've got the comparison between doctors. I mean, I think the big question here is, what kind of diagnoses are we talking about here? If you picked certain types of diagnoses that you could kind of bias it towards these synthetic doctors. So I could see it that way, but I don't think they would do that. 20% seems huge, but now with the databases of medical information we have on hand, this time had to come at some point. So basically, I just have no idea.
You have to pick one.
That's where you started, Bob.
Three separate and misaligned planet-forming disks, not planets, but. All right, planet-forming disk fiction.
Why don't you take these news items out on a little vacation?
Wait, Bob, did I hear you make a choice there?
Yes, you did. Planet-forming fiction before Jay said his little
Okay.
Insult.
Because you actually read the words in the item this time and gloss over them. All right, Jay.
The first one about the astronomers, that, and they discovered this solar system that has these three separate and misaligned planet-forming disks. That is a little strange. The second one about nanoengineers have created the these nanoparticles, and I like the whole Lego-like building block thing. It seems like a really cool idea. I love it. I don't see any reason why we couldn't be doing stuff like that. And then this last one here about the head-to-head comparison between the doctors and the computers. I mean, you know, in short, I agree. I think it was Evan that said, or Bob, that they compile these big databases now. And I think that we have sufficient AI systems that could work with the data and really know how to navigate it. You know, it's an expert system. We have expert systems now that do this right now. So what we're saying is they came out with a new expert system that's really good. They outperform the doctors by 20%. So an expert in the field being beat by a computer by 20%. I don't even think I think this one is the fiction because I don't think there's a 20% tolerance there. I don't think it could beat a doctor in the field by 20% because I don't think there's that much of a variance. I bet you it's like 2%. That's where I put my
similar to what I thought. Yep.
Okay, Kara.
I think there are certain fields of medicine in which a computer would totally be better than a doctor in like a major way, like radiology. Or like, you know, looking at film, I'm sure computers can find things that are like pixels of, you know, just significant difference to a computer is way lower than to a human eye. So I'm sure there are other fields where there's so much art in the diagnostics, you know, with differentials that like they do way worse. But I think in certain fields, I could see computers doing way better. So shit. I got to go with this one just because, A, I don't think it's the first time, and B, I actually think that that number is all over the place. I think sometimes it's probably twice as much. Sometimes it's probably half as bad.
Okay, so we'll start with number two, since you all agree on that one. Nanoengineers have created a system that transforms nanoparticles into universal, modular, Lego-like building blocks. You all think that one is the science, and that one is... science.
Better. Yay. Right.
Yeah. Yes.
50-50.
Legos. Holy crap. Details. Details, please.
So, yeah. They're really pushing the Lego analogy here, but it does seem to be fairly reasonable. What they did was...
I hate Legos.
They used a polyphenol adhesive material, which they attached to these nanoparticles, creating what they call these CG studs. They form multiple anchor points that are universal, meaning that any particle can attach to any other particle through these multiple attachment points. So it's like the studs in a Lego brick, you know, that are universal. They can attach to any other Lego brick. That's where the analogy comes from. So, and then the way they're using them is that essentially you have like a template. And then if you have these modular nanoparticles, you know, wash over the template, they will assemble themselves into and bind together in the correct configuration based upon the template. That's how they're doing it. So hopefully they'll be able to further mature this system. They're, you know, they want to be able to essentially, you know, build any shape that they need out of the particles using this system, this Lego system of the adhesive, the polyphenol adhesive studs, forming multiple attachment points between any two of the particles. Pretty cool.
Wow, yeah. Very cool.
Okay, let's see. Which one should I go to next?
Three. Go to three. Go to three.
Let's go to number three.
Oh, the pain, the pain.
Why do you think that matters at this
point? I don't know, Steve. I don't know why they get so excited.
It's like in one moment we can turn off our skeptical brains and go totally emotional on it.
In the first head-to-head comparison.
I don't know why they get so excited, Steve.
Between doctors and computer-based diagnostic systems, the computer-based systems outperform the human doctors in making correct diagnoses by 20%.
Too high.
Jay, Evan, and Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. Bob, you think this one is science. So to clarify a couple of points here before I give you the answer, we're not talking about reading films because that's more image recognition. This is making a diagnosis based upon like symptoms. Like here's five symptoms. What's the diagnosis?
Dang it. So not just like it's a, I diagnose you with a tumor that I have read on your film.
No, but okay. Yeah, but like interpreting digital data, that's that would put that in a different category than making a diagnosis. That's
gotcha.
Reading information. And we have that, we have systems for that, for reading EEGs and MRI scans, any data, you know, that and those of course they assist the human reader, right? They show like this, there might be something here, you better look over here, or they flag stuff, you know, for the humans to review. Sure. And it is very, very helpful. But here we're talking about, here's a list of symptoms, what's the diagnosis for this patient? And you guys were, you know, range of opinions there, but I'll say that this one is the fiction. So what do you think the real number is?
I would think it's very low, you know, between 2 and 5%.
My guess that, was equal.
You'd like
I'm
to think
say
that.
I'm going to say it was, it's not low, it's higher.
Is it higher?
So this was the first head-to-head comparison. So this head-to-head comparison, this is the first one that was published at least.
Okay.
Physicians typically, it depends on the complexity, obviously, but, you know, on average, physicians will make the wrong diagnosis about 15% of the time. But the human doctors did much better than the computer by about twice. They did about twice as well as the computer. The more complicated the diagnosis, the greater the gap, the better the humans did than the computers. The computers did better. The gap was much smaller for very like everyday diagnoses, very common things. But the more obscure it got, the better the humans did, I think, because, you know, as the complexity went up, the pattern recognition, which humans are very good at, you know, had a much bigger advantage. And that, you know, you can get kind of lost in the noise if you're taking more of an analytical approach. But if you augment the analytical approach with the intuitive approach, which is really just pattern recognition, that's where experienced doctors have a huge advantage in that pattern recognition.
Is this Watson, Steve?
No, it was not. It was actually, they compared it to a bunch of different systems, and they kind of like took the average performance, and humans did better than all of them. So better than any currently available system. And I do think we will get there, but we're not quite there yet. And again, there's also, this is missing an entire element, which is the developing the list of symptoms in the first place. That's where most of the work actually occurs, because you're interacting with a human. And humans are horrible communicators. They're horrible historians. People's memories suck. They're biased all over the place. There's confirmation bias and false. You know, you have to filter through so much noise when you are distilling the patient's history from all the nonsense that they're telling you, and all the noise that they're telling you. And also, you have to try to figure out when a symptom is significant or not, because they'll tell you the patients don't know what's significant. They're just telling you everything, or maybe they're underreporting. They may be stoic. You know, they're underreporting. So judging which symptoms are significant is a huge part of the human interaction when you're trying to distill your history. So once you get down to, these are the symptoms that I think are connected and significant, and you plug them into the system, you've already done 90% of the work, you know? But then an expert system is useful in that it might say, all right, here are the five things you should think about, you know, in terms of most likely to least likely. And maybe you thought of four of them, but you didn't think of the fifth one. You're like, okay, I'll add this blood test because I didn't think of that fifth obscure one or whatever. But in terms of like picking the most likely diagnosis, the doctors were much better than the computers, because they just have better judgment from experience about, you know, how to weight different symptoms and how to weight the different pieces of information. But it's also just a limitation of the expert systems. The expert systems aren't capturing that experience sufficiently. And part of that is because connecting these two experts, physician experts and computer experts, is really hard. And you really need this dual expertise to be able to capture that diagnostic expertise in a computer system. You know what I mean? All right, let's go back to number one. Astronomers have discovered a solar system with three separate and misaligned planet-forming disks. This is science and totally effing cool. Never even occurred to me that this could be possible. This is what I love about this. You always just imagine one plane of planets revolving. Obviously, there could be the occasional captured planet, Bob, which you brought up. But these are disks. These are disks forming planets, not just a couple of random captured planets. This is a system with two stars, which is very common.
But that would only account for like two of them.
Yeah, right? So there's one plane of planet-forming disks around each star, and then there's a third big one that runs between them. So like they collectively have one big planetary-forming disk, and then they each have a small one of their own, all in completely different planes. What an awesome solar system that would be, right?
Wow. Oh, wow.
But that means that there's going to be some pretty epic collisions in the future, I think.
Well, they will clear out their planetary orbits, you know.
That's true.
Right? I mean, yes, there will be, but there are in every planetary solar system. Mm-hmm. When astronomers use computer models to look at like how solar systems, even one clean planet-forming disk, how they form, there's interactions all over the place. Planets will get flung out. Most planets will get flung out of the system. And then you're left with just the few very stable planetary orbits. So I'm assuming the same thing would happen here. It might be more chaotic initially, but you know, you could see a couple of planets hugging each of the stars and then other planets in big orbits around the whole thing, and they're nowhere near each other. Yeah, that'd be cool. I hope we find more of those. That's just fascinated.
That is really cool. I'd love to see that.
Yeah. All right. Well, good job, guys. Bob. Tough break this week.
Well, you can't blame me for picking one.
Yeah. No, it was tough. That was a good one. It was cool.
He didn't want to.
I know too goddamn much.
Is that what makes you feel better?
Gotcha.
I like how that sounds.
It is true. I mean, I get to listen to all you guys thinking your way through these. And, you know, so lots of times you guys don't know enough to get it wrong. Meaning there's something that should be surprising about an item, but you're not that surprised about it because you don't realize how surprising it is. And sometimes...
Yeah, like I didn't know that planet one was surprising, but Bob did.
But exactly. That does happen a lot. So there is some legitimacy to what Bob is saying. And Bob and I
think you planned these just for that effect.
Well, it's, I do. I mean, the things that surprise me are the ones that I use.
Right.
And you and I have a lot of overlap in our interests. So I think things that surprise me are more likely to surprise you. So
I'm going to remind you of this conversation in December.
I've never denied it.
Bob, your averages always come out high. Don't worry.
It has. But not this...
Year. All right, shite.
Evan, give us a quote.
This quote comes to us courtesy of a listener, Drew Hartley from Texas, suggested this week's quote. Thank you, Drew. Keep the company of those who seek the truth. Run from those who have found it. And that was spoken or written by Vaclav Havel, who was a writer, philosopher, and the last president of Czechoslovakia, also the first president of the Czech Republic.
Cool.
And I knew certainly of the name Vaclav Havel growing up as a child. He was an activist against oppressive communism in Czechoslovakia in the 60s and 70s. Spoke about him quite often in classes in school, and someone very much to be admired. And thought that was a very, very, very good quote.
Imagine having a philosopher as a president.
I'm
afraid to find that difficult to imagine.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to cry now.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Steve.
That was truth with a small T, by the way. Yep. Small T.
Thank you.
Not capital T truth. There is no such thing. Right.
Here.
Okay. Well, thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
Thank you all for joining me this week.
Righto, sir. Sure.
Good to be here again.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.